And welcome to Midday this afternoon. My guest today is Ivan Bates, the state's attorney for the city of Baltimore. State's Attorney Bates took office in 2023, and over the past couple of years, the city has seen a sharp drop in violent crimes. According to the state's attorney's office, nearly 2,600 violent repeat offenders have been incarcerated, and the SA office has won more than 270 homicide convictions. But as we've seen throughout this period of declining rates of crime, being safe and feeling safe can often be two very different things. The state's attorney has said curbing quality of life crimes is also a big priority, as well as continuing the decline that we've seen in homicides and non-fatal shootings. State's Attorney Bates joins me here for the hour in Studio A. It's good to see you, sir.
Hey, good to see you. Thank you so much for having me.
And since the last time we saw you, you've gotten married, so congratulations on that.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
And there's a lot to be congratulated on. You and the mayor and the U.S. attorney and a whole, you know, phalanx of law enforcement officials and folks trying to make the city safer. I think by, you know, any measure, the city is safer. What's your take on what's worked and what needs to be done moving forward?
Well, look, I think the number one thing that has worked is partnership. People always ask me, you know, give me a word to describe what's worked, partnership. But even then, I had to look specifically at the state's attorney's office. We first came in, the office was demoralized, 140 prosecutors. That's not enough to do the job. Now we have 200 prosecutors. We could probably use another 20, 30, 40, 50 easily. However, you know, we've filled our pens. And the one thing that was very important, when I came on January 3rd, 2023, we set the tone. We said, you know, technically bring a toothbrush. And in saying that, that was the message to the criminal element, the repeat violent offenders, that the what you were doing was no longer going to be accepted. If you were going to run around with illegal handguns, you are going to go to prison. And what we decided to do is, you know, we've now charged a lot of young individuals who have these guns and older individuals who have these guns and these records. Now they're doing 5 years without the possibility of parole. Long enough for them to hopefully understand what's going on, change their behavior, but long enough to give the neighborhoods the opportunity to understand what's going on, to heal from the trauma these individuals are inflicting. That has really, really worked. You have the carrot and the stick. So by being the stick, now the carrot, where you see some of these other programs the mayor has and Monzie has, now they are able to now work. Because before it was like, oh, you should change your life. Well, why do you want to change your life unless there's no reason to do it? If you're going to sit out here, you're going to rob and steal and hustle, you're never going to go to jail, why do you want to change your life? Now, oh, you know what, I can definitely go to jail. So you know what, let me take your offer on going ahead and getting services. And so that's where you see the partnership. You see police are policing now. Now, before they would make an arrest of an illegal handgun, a felon, and that person would be right out. And so why do the police want to necessarily make the arrest? Because they're risking their life. Now they make that arrest, that person goes to prison. So when you look at that process, you're holding violent offenders accountable, but the people who really benefit are the individuals in the community, the victims. And for us, what we really needed to do was focus on the victims. And I feel that's really what we've been able to do in the office.
In 2020, we watched on videotape as a Minneapolis police officer murdered George Floyd. We had the murder of Breonna Taylor in a screwed up raid in Louisville. Protests and marches across the country, across the world. I mean, they were marching in London. They were marching in Rome. They were marching in Nairobi. They were marching everywhere for equitable policing, for the Black Lives Matter movement. Corporations got into the act. Nonprofits got into the act. Equity and DEI was elevated. We're now 5 years later. And what we're talking about as repeat violent offenders, it seems to me that 5 years ago, these were people in communities, you know, who were over-incarcerated. The rhetoric about, we heard about neighborhoods devastated because entire blocks full of young men were being incarcerated. And the assumption was, the intimation was that they were being incarcerated unduly, they were being incarcerated unfairly, they were being incarcerated for crimes that didn't really merit incarceration. Is this a pendulum swing thing, or in your view, or is it what is it? Mm-hmm. Because it's so much, the climate is so much different now. Because what you're saying, I think, has happened, and what you're saying, I think, has gotten overwhelming support. But it, boy, it's different than it was 5 years ago, well, the way we're talking about it.
No, I agree. I think what happened is the pendulum went too far. What we have done, we focused on not everybody. We focused on the right individuals. So what happened was we were saying we'd want to basically de-incarcerate almost everybody. The problem was that in doing that, relaxing, you had violent individuals who were preying on regular citizens. They were preying on good people. And look, I understand, and people ask me all the time, oh, well, you don't think you're locking up black men and brown men. I'm black myself. But have you looked at the victims? The victims of these robberies oftentimes are also black. And so we have to decide and stop making excuses for individuals. These individuals that we're going after, they've already been given a shot. They've been given a chance. They probably were given probation. A lot of them were given probation for the one, two. This could be the third gun. They were on parole for an attempt murder, a robbery. These aren't the individuals that have never been incarcerated. They've never been in trouble before. These are the individuals that are repeat and they're violent and they keep offending. These are the individuals that, once again, we're not asking for 50 years. Even the research shows, for us, when we came in, the research said there were about 5 to 6 violent repeat offenders that were basically causing havoc in Baltimore. We removed half of them. Removing half of them going to do what? But what people don't also realize, they were 40% of the murder victims. So now, yes, they're in jail, but they're not dead. And now they have an opportunity. Now what we need to do, and we hopefully will be seeing some things from our office soon, we need to go into jails and give these individuals the education and training, the opportunity that they need. Because I do believe in second chances, but you're going to earn that second chance. But the one thing I really believe in, you know, I go to church right there on McCullough Mosier, and we can't really have late night afternoon services because the older adults aren't coming because they're tired of being preyed upon by individuals in that neighborhood who look like me and who look like them. And so what we need to do is make sure that we get our neighborhoods so that people feel safe. And if there are some individuals who have been the repeat violent offenders who've been preying on these individuals with their violence, then yes, they're going to have to sit down. However, get yourself together. It's not 20 years. It's 5 years about to possibly roll, which is about, realistically, you're sitting about 4 years. And then you come home. But when you come home, be prepared to change your mindset, or else then you could potentially go back to prison. There must be rules, and there must be. Remember, I'm not saying this because, you know, I just read all this in a book. I was a criminal defense attorney for 20 years. And I was a criminal defense attorney where my clients would say, never forget, I had a young man. He had caught with his gun second time. I get him out on bail. He comes to see me, and we're talking. He gets up, and his new gun falls out of his dip in front of me. This was his third gun. He was 19 years of age. And I said, what are we doing here? He was like, well, come on, base, I'm not going to jail. And that's when things really clicked. When you hold individuals accountable, then they will change their behavior. I don't enjoy locking up individuals, especially the ones who look like me or really anybody. But I really don't like talking to victims, a mother and a father who's lost their loved one.
On the dashboard that you publish in the state's attorney's website, you list about 2,100 people who have been held accountable, right? So sometimes that's incarceration, sometimes it's other things. But you control part of the process. You basically are in charge of the largest law firm in the United, yes. in the city of Baltimore.
Yes, sir.
You know, I mean, hundreds of lawyers. I know you'd like some more, but you control a lot of lawyers. You don't control the judges.
Yes.
And people used to complain. When I say used to, I mean that for real, because people don't complain so much anymore, it seems to me, about the laxity of the judges, you know, letting these guys off. We heard a lot about that a few years ago. We're not hearing so much about that anymore. Has there been a change in the judicial approach to the cases you're bringing before the courts?
Well, two things have happened. One, there's been a change because, remember, the judges live in our community as well. So they're seeing. They go to the churches. They go to the malls. They're part of the community as well, so they see and they hear. But the other thing is, when we bring a case with a repeat violent offender and we invoke the mandatory minimum 5 years without the possibility of parole, the judge can't do anything. They must give them 5 years without the possibility of parole. So we've taken that discretion away from the court because that's what the General Assembly said was our right to do, to make that choice, to make that decision. And so we have filed that, not in every single case, but in the cases we see repeat violent offenders. For instance, if you're, say, you're a father, you're a 45, 46-year-old individual, you had a robbery when you were in your teens, you're working, but now the police execute a search and seizure warrant looking for your son or looking for your daughter, and they find your gun, technically you're a repeat violent offender. You're 5 years about to possibly parole. That's not the individual we're looking at. That's an individual, yes, you're not allowed to have the gun, but we want you to still stay in the community, give you probation. You can continue to have your job, but understand the gun laws and rules. We've been more, I would say this, we have been smart on crime. We're not going on everybody. Before, you had the mass incarceration, we're just grabbing everybody to grab them. But that didn't work. But what does work is being smart on crime, focusing on those 5,000 to 6,000 violent repeat offenders and changing their behavior so when they come home, there's something for them to come home to.
Well, I will say that as I talk to folks in the violence interrupting community, folks that work with Safe Streets, folks that work with ROCA, folks that work with We Are Us, you know, and I talk to them pretty regularly. But off the record, they will tell me that folks on the street know the name Ivan Bates. You know, and they know that you ain't messing around. And that's a good rep to have. But you still need, as you said at the very top of our conversation here, these partnerships with other, with MONSI, the Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement, with the nonprofits that are working, with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Yeah. What's your relationship with Kelly Hayes? She is the new U.S. Attorney here in Maryland, an appointee of Donald Trump. It's a different ball game in Washington. Is it a different ball game here in Baltimore?
No, we have a really good relationship. We actually were together yesterday at a HIDA meeting. Last week,
what's HIDA?
HIDA is high intensity drug trafficking. It's a group of federal partners and state partners. We get together and we talk about what's going on, crime, drug overdose, what can we do, how can we work with all of this process. And so it was a very good meeting. But one of the things, last week we had two prosecutors from our office. They became SAUSAs, means state's attorney in the U.S. Attorney's Office. So they're working with them. Look, at the end of the day, one thing that I realized, crime, we don't talk about your political views. We talk about public safety. Public safety doesn't matter if you're Republican, Democrat. Doesn't matter if you're black or white. Doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. Anyone at any time could be a victim. It's our job and our duty to work together to make sure that we keep the public safe. I don't get into all the politics of all of that because if I do, I don't feel I could do my job effectively. I have to look at everything in black and white and hold the violent offenders accountable, but I have to work with the partners to be able to do the best job possible. I take very seriously, look, they
But
voted
you're
for
getting it. Cooperation from the Trump administration?
Oh, we do. We get cooperation. We get a lot of cooperation from the U.S. Attorney's Office. We work very closely, and we're able to get the job done together. We're working with other agencies, whether it's the FBI, whether it's the DEA, whether it's, you know, ATF. We're working closely
You're making
together.
Decisions like we're going to make this a federal prosecution because the sentences are longer, those kinds of decisions with this current administration?
Oh, we sure do. We sure do. We have some big cases, and we've been able to get some large amounts of drugs off the streets. And you know, hey, my prosecutors would really like to prosecute this on the federal side. Can they go along with it? Oh, sure, definitely. We work together for the betterment of everybody.
Ivan Bates is the state's attorney for the city of Baltimore. We'll have more with the state's attorney in just a little bit. Welcome back to Midday. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, Maryland Congresswoman April McLean Delaney will join me to discuss a possible government shutdown and other issues affecting not just the 6th District, which she represents, but the entire state of Maryland. Plus, I'll speak with Stephanie Mavronis, the head of the Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement, and Jeremy Biddle, a violence reduction expert who has been a consultant with the city. That's coming up tomorrow. And if you've just joined us today, my guest is Ivan Bates. He's the Baltimore City State's Attorney. You can send us an email if you have a question or comment for the state's attorney. Our address, midday@wipr.org. So, Mr. State's Attorney, let's talk about Monsey. I'm going to be speaking, as I just mentioned, with Stephanie Mavronis, who runs that agency tomorrow. In the last few weeks, you've had some questions, particularly about Safe Streets, the violence interruption program that Monsey oversees, and which, you know, the mayor and Stephanie and others, you know, credit as a real important dimension of the group violence reduction strategy that has, you know, apparently been quite effective over these last few years. Do you have a problem with Safe Streets? What are your observations about them?
No. Look, you have to remember, I was a criminal defense attorney, so some of my former clients are there. So I have different insight because I have different conversations that give me pause and concern about certain things. But there's one thing in particular that really kind of caught my eye. In The Guardian, there's an article in which they spoke to individuals from Safe Streets. They talked about the night of the most deadly mass shooting in the state of Maryland, in Brooklyn. They stopped 5 fights. Well, of these 5 fights, we still have a mass shooting. So my question is, really, what are we doing? How are we monitoring? And that's been all my question. I've never doubted their work. But, you know, what are we doing? How are we really monitoring if the person later carried their threat out after they just appeased you for a second, then they went behind your back and did what they wanted to? Things like that. That really are things that, see, in my office, you can see our numbers because our numbers are right there. But with Monsey, with Safe Streets, my question is really, what's going on? How is this happening? How do you monitor this? You say, I think they said 1,000 violence interruptions. Well, there are 80 people. So are you did 5 in one night? Are you not doing anything? What are your hour? How do we connect? All those things. And those aren't just my questions. Those are the questions for people in the community that sit out there and they ask me, look, I think one of the things.
So is it a matter that they should be doing more? I mean, if they've had 1,100 interactions with people, I mean, isn't one of the problems with being accountable in that realm is that you're trying to track what didn't happen? You know, if they have interactions that prevent a violent incident, how do you write that down? How do you put that on an Excel spreadsheet? Well,
then you've talked about these people you've spoken to. But what if you try to prevent it and actually didn't happen, that it still happened anyway? How do we note that? Now, you know, I don't like the secrecy because I'm also saying I'm comparing this to what they do in New York. In New York, everybody knows what's going on. In New York, they go to roll calls. In New York, they go out to community walks. In New York, they understand the hot spots.
The safe streets. Go into roll calls with the police department.
And they understand the hot spots. They understand those issues. What I'm saying is that I don't really understand how you're using them, but if I'm looking at how other organizations that have a Safe Streets type mentality, like up in New York, I see them being used differently. I see them having data that they're able to account for differently. I'm not saying they're not doing their job. I'm saying it's difficult for me to understand, especially when you say, oh, well, we can't give you the information. We can't tell you who these people are. In New York, everybody knows who they are. In the communities, everybody knows who the people are. If you're running around in orange shorts, we know who you are. Just go ahead. What I understand is this. When you're using people's tax dollars, try to be as transparent as possible. But when you're sitting there hiding behind, well, we can't do this for their safety, but they're running in the streets in the community in orange shirts. And if it's for their safety, how are we allowed to connect with them if we need them one way or another? Things like that. It just doesn't smell right to me. I'm not saying anything is wrong with it. I'm saying there are some issues.
Yeah, you are. You're saying it doesn't smell right.
When I say anything is wrong with the philosophy, I don't necessarily look at
the way. Because isn't it true? Because they the whole point of a violence interruption element in this group violence reduction strategy is that they are doing things that the police or your office can't do. I mean, isn't the point for Safe Streets, ROCA, We Are Us, these groups that are out there on the street, talking to folks directly with credibility because they've lived the life, they've been, many of these folks working for Safe Streets have been incarcerated, they know what the consequences are, and they're able to share those experiences in a way that a police officer or a state's attorney, assistant state's attorney can't.
And I understand that, but ROCA gives me great stats. ROCA's letting us know what's going on. We Are Us, They're the same way. We have great stats. We're able to look to see. There are three organizations. Two of the three, I have great stats, I have great information. I'm able to track what's going on. They're very transparent. The third organization isn't. I'm not saying that they're not doing the job. My issue is the lack of transparency because I have so many more questions, especially because when I read an article in The Guardian that talks about how they stopped five fights and then there's a mass shooting, but then I also look around how, you know, we stopped individuals who had guns about to shoot each other, but then there's no information about that. What went on? What happened? You know, things like that, I'm just curious. If you're so transparent, why are you going to give all this information to The Guardian, but we don't ever hear anything about it ourselves?
All right. Of course, The Guardian is based in London, too, by the
way. Well, and exactly.
Not that, you know, The Guardian is a bad... I contribute to The Guardian. Yeah, I'm a fan of The Guardian.
Exactly,
but,
exactly.
You know, I mean, in terms of knowing what's going on the street, it's an interesting dilemma because I think the credibility of Safe Streets, the fact that folks will engage with them and talk to them is partially premised on the fact that they're not working hand in glove with the police department, for example. Isn't that part of the credibility?
It is, but we're not asking for that. I'm just asking for you to keep your data, and your data, everything is passed. And, you know, follow up. Okay, if John Smith called you to said, you know, hey, you know, I'm mad, I'm about to shoot, you know, Mike, and then you talk him down, and then a month later, John Smith's arrested for murder, what's going on with that case? You know, is that a win or is it not a win, and where do we fail? How do you go back and measure where you've been successful and where you failed, and how do you fix those failures?
All right, and we will, of course, have a conversation about that very thing, I promise, tomorrow with Stephanie Mavronis, who runs Monsey. But now I want to switch gears and talk about the possibility of state police being kind of surged into Baltimore. The governor and the mayor had a community walk in Park Heights last week. I don't know if it's coincidental, but, you know, at the same time that President Trump's been talking about what a hellhole Baltimore is and he's going to bring the National Guard in, the governor did say that he would increase the presence of state police. Do you think that's a good idea? What should the state police be doing, and how will your office coordinate with that?
Yeah, you know, I definitely think it's a good idea. I think it's something that when you look at the Baltimore City Police Department, you know, I think finally they got back to 2,000 officers. They're having, spoke to the commissioner, they're having classes once again, full class of officers, but they're short. Anytime he gets some help is very important. I think the simple fact that President Trump was you know, with the National Guard, I think what the governor said is like, oh, we don't need your help, we can do it ourselves. And he's so showing that, he's supporting Baltimore City. And that's really important. Now, I talked to the police commissioner and say, how are they gonna do this? They're gonna walk around, they're gonna do certain things. A lot of them still, I believe, traffic stops and things like that, that they're really good and trained at and trained with. But also they'll be able to write some citations and things like that. So I think from my standpoint, however they decide to use them, that's not my call. That's the police commissioner. That is the commissioner of the state police. That's their call about what's best for policing. We're here to support them in any way they need.
You've talked a lot about quality of life crimes.
Yes.
So obviously, you know, the homicides, the non-fatal shootings are way down. I mean, we're at 96 homicides as of today, the 17th of September. This time of year, 3 years ago, we were at 250-something. So, I mean, the change is remarkable. But when you talk about quality of life crimes, what do you mean by those? And what are you hearing from folks that you talk to at community meetings? And what are you guys doing about it?
Well, in community meetings, that's when they're burning me up about quality of life. For instance, in Federal Hill, talking about the 35 to 40-some people that had their car windows broken in. That's quality of life issue. You're also talking about the person who can't go out on their own stoop because they're sitting outside selling drugs. That's a quality of life issue. You're talking about the person who basically is coming in their neighborhood purchasing drugs. That's a quality of life issue. And so for us, we're talking about, look, we're not going to arrest our way out of this. But if you give a citation to that person who's purchased drugs, the officer can go ahead and get the drugs, seize the drugs. Now they have something to look to see, okay, do these drugs match this drug crew if I later make the arrest? But you also now can direct that individual to the citation docket. The citation docket will go ahead to say, hey, do 5 hours of community service, and we're offering you inpatient or outpatient drug treatment at no cost whatsoever to you. And you're not on probation or have any criminal record. And so when I look at quality of life, it's loitering, it's trespass. It's those types of issues. Excuse me. It's the dirt bikes. Good gosh. You talk about the dirt bikes. You know, I had a friend recently that was given a ticket and lives down there in the area, right down in Inner Harbor, was given a ticket because his license plate wasn't attached the way it needed to be attached. And so he was like, okay, but you know, I'm tired because what about the dirt bikers? He was told, and the police officer told him, well, we're not allowed to stop them. We can't do anything. We have to engage them and figure out.
Well, who doesn't allow them to stop them?
I guess the police department.
That's so that's a police policy? That's a regulation?
That's what he told me, in the sense that I think for him, for an officer to tell a regular tax-paying individual, hey, we're not allowed to stop him.
But it's possible the officer is misinformed.
It's very, very possible. I know, speaking to the police commissioner, I know the officers have been trained. I think they may actually have a special task force that does that. But what I'm saying is that those are the types of quality of life crimes that people are frustrated with. When you live down there and it's 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, I know you have that big older adult building down there. So it's 2 o'clock in the morning. You can barely get to sleep. You're on heart medication. You hear all these bikes. You're now awake because of that situation. That's the quality of life. That's when people leave the area, because they just want to feel comfortable. They want to be able to walk out their own door and feel comfortable and not think that someone's going to rob them, attack them, beat them. That's the quality of life.
But is the citation docket catching on? Because, you know, we've talked about this. I've talked about this with the commissioner. I've talked about it with the mayor. You know, maybe one of those good ideas that just somehow is not getting implemented to the extent that it needs to be in order to actually be effective. I mean, where does it stand right now? You getting enough action at the citation docket?
We're not getting the action we need. And that's sad. And I think it's a great idea, but we need them to write the citations. We have talked to the police. We have educated the police. They're going to have to write the citations on their own. I can't make them. The mayor can sit down and say, hey, this is important. This is something we're going to mandate you need to do. However, you know, right now, we put it together. We just hope they use it.
You had a meeting with Betsy Fox Tolentino, who is the new director of the Department of Juvenile Services. I know you and the Betsy Tolentino's predecessor, Vinnie Schiraldi, had some disagreements about, you know, the approach to juvenile crime. You're meeting with her. Do you think that the two of you are more compatible than you've been in the past?
Well, I think we are. I think, you know, look, I don't like locking up young people. I never think that's good. I always want young people to get the services that they need. But once again, I'm about victims. I have to protect the victims. I do think that she sees what's going on. I think, unfortunately, she has a lot that she's inherited, and it's going to take her some time to work through it, to put her policies in place. I think we need to give her the time. I think we need to give her the support. I think her and I see a lot more close eye to eye. There's some things that she wants that I just don't want, and that's natural. However, overall, I think when you look at one of the policies, that if a young person's already on CDE, I'm electronic home detention, and they go out and commit another crime, that young person will be held. I think that's a fair policy. You're giving a young person an opportunity, but if they don't want to act right, then they're going to continue those behavior, then you're going to hold them for a little while.
Baltimore City State's Attorney Ivan Bates is with us today until the top of the hour. And if you have a question or comment for the state's attorney, you're welcome to drop us an email, which is midday@wipr.org. We're going to talk a little bit about the fact that it's our fall membership campaign. And when we come back, we will take a couple of calls and emails. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Baltimore City State's Attorney Ivan Bates. President Donald Trump's claim that Baltimore is a crime-infested hellhole notwithstanding, Baltimore has had fewer homicides this year than in any similar period in the last 50 years. Ivan Bates joins me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well online. Midday@wipr.org is our email address. We do have a caller in Lauraville. Brian is on the line, or Byron, excuse me. Byron, welcome to the program with the state's attorney.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I'm also known as Buzz. Hello, Mr. Bates. Let me say right off the bat, I'm a supporter of yours. I voted for you, and I've been a resident here since 1993.
Hello, thank you.
I would like
you
to know why
thank
Mr. Bates
much.
Hasn't made clear to ICE what Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner has publicly stated, that his office may prosecute ICE agents who commit crimes such as illegal assaults, kidnapping while operating in Philadelphia. To me, not being absolutely clear, as Mr. Krasner did, is giving tacit approval to kidnapping, assault, terrorizing our immigrant community, and quite frankly, contributes to making those types of tactics normalized. I would appreciate your comment.
Well, thank you very much for your support. You know, with us, we as an office sat down and talked about the best way to try to handle this. One of the things that we looked at was that seemed like every time someone tried to jump up and say what we're not going to do, then it almost seemed like then ICE and some of those other entities focus on that particular area in a particular city to try to show them what they were going to do. We have gone out to the immigrant community to be as supportive as possible, to let them know what their rights were, to let them know what we would do, or how we try to protect them and their rights, whether it's U visa and other issues. And we try to do that as much as possible. However, I think it's been pretty clear, and you know, I understand why you'd say, you know, you should say it, you know, nice and loud, that if you're going to rob or kidnap or abuse people, without a doubt, we definitely will prosecute those individuals. We just felt that we didn't need to run out there and just scream and say it, because sometime in saying that, are we potentially hurting that community even worse? Because now they're like, well, it's almost a challenge. And I've kind of looked at what that administration has done, and it's almost if you say something, they're going to show you the exact opposite.
Are you aware of any instance across the country in which an ICE agent has actually been arrested by local law enforcement?
Not really, but I believe, if I'm not mistaken, in Chicago, I think they had one where an ICE agent may have shot an individual. They're looking into that, and I would not be shocked if an ICE agent was charged with that shooting. I think also in California, there's a bill now to try to unmask, and so that you'll be able to see who their faces are. It's a little difficult because you may not know who they are. So you think about it. If an ICE agent comes and snatches someone, grabs someone, you don't know who they are, how do you identify them? What do you do to identify them? So I think one of the things, unlike regular police officers where they have their badge number, you can see their face and they have their body camera footage, it's more difficult. And so I think one of the things maybe the legislature may want to look in to say, hey, you know, if you're going to be of law enforcement, you know, very similar to what the law they're trying to do in California. And so in that regard, that's why we haven't been jumping up and down. You know, the whole process involving the federal government, everything, we have decided that as a group, as an office, we're focusing on our job. We're going to allow the politicians to focus on those issues. But on our issues, our job, there are a lot of people who are in this country, and we need to make sure that we protect them because they can be victims as well.
Obviously, if the president follows through on his sometime threat, which he's backed off of a little bit in the last 10 days or so, to send the National Guard to Baltimore, he's talked about sending them to Memphis, he's talked about sending them to Chicago, et cetera. That may be a matter for the city's attorney, Ebony Thompson, or because it's a very different situation than in Washington, in which, you know, Congress and the president have much more control over that city's government. But is your office going to be involved should that happen? If the National Guard comes, what is your responsibility? What is your obligation as you see it in negotiating that, in executing that, in handling that?
I think, like you said, that's, we look at it from the standpoint, that's the city solicitor, Ebony Thompson, and the mayor, as well as the governor, who has Anthony Brown, the attorney general. I think a lot of times what people don't always understand and see ethically, we don't really jump up and say a lot, because let's say the National Guard do come in, and let's say they didn't make an arrest, and let's say we decide not to prosecute. Next thing they're going to say is like, oh, you know what? Ivan Bates already never wanted to prosecute our cases, and he's wrong. So then a victim who's may have been victimized will feel that we've done something illegal. Our best bet is to just go ahead, not say a word, allow other individuals that do not have to be in the criminal justice system say what they need to say and what they feel they need to say, and for us to do our job. When that case comes, and if it comes, we'll be prepared to handle it the appropriate manner. If we do have an ICE agent who does anything criminal in nature and we can identify them, yes, we will prosecute that individual. No different than we would prosecute anybody that would do something illegal.
One of the things that you've been involved in is scams and frauds that are inflicted on older adults in particular. AARP reports that last year nearly $5 billion in losses were sustained by older people, and that's up almost 50% from the year before. Then most of these victims, 63 years and older. There's a luncheon that you're going to attend yes. tomorrow in which you're going to talk about this. What kinds of crimes are you seeing, and what can your office do to prevent them?
Yeah, like you said, tomorrow we have a luncheon. We have over 900 older adults, in which we're bringing them in. We're paying for the luncheon, and we're just going to give them the education, let them know that when you're a victim of crime, these are the numbers you call. But we see a lot of things. For instance, you see relatives that are stealing from their older adults, whether it's the grandmother, the aunt, the uncle. And so you have a younger relative who's supposed to be a caretaker, and then they're taking the money. And so a lot of times that victim doesn't want to say anything. You have the victim who's being physically and mentally abused by the caretaker, who's a relative as well. Those types of crimes. But also you have the individual that receives a call and they say, oh my goodness, your grandson is, you know, been in jail and they need $400 as soon as possible. Oh my goodness, they're so afraid to give $400. Why would you do that? And things like that. Letting them understand, when you see these text messages say, you know, if you don't pay your back taxes and $200, we're going to report you to the police. Letting them understand, like, this is a scam, and these are the numbers that you would need to call to reach out to us before you pay any money. Reach out to this governmental organization before you pay any money. Just trying to educate the older adult population. We're able to do this through our older adult division. Remember when I came in, one of the things I promised when I was on the campaign trail is that we would have an older adult division that would go ahead and focus on the issues involving the older adults. And we have been able to do that. And also, one of the big cases that we talked about, and we did, I think it came about of our first or second older adult luncheon, we had information about a contractor who was just stealing from older adults left and right. So we prosecuted that individual, and he received 20 years in jail for stealing from a number of older adults around Baltimore City and other jurisdictions.
Two quick questions for you as we finish up here. I got about a minute left. The city just received at the end of last month a $62 million verdict against a guy or a company that was dealing ghost guns. Where does that money go? What do you do with that?
Well, I don't know. Look, that was a small dealer. I don't know if we're going to be able to get the $62 million, and that person's going to appeal, and they'll probably file for bankruptcy. But that's the type of money that could go into many youth programs, can go in the state's attorney's office for specific prosecutors to deal with gun violence and things like that.
Are you running for mayor?
No, right now I'm running for state's attorney, and that's what I have to run for next year.
All right. Had to ask. You know how that works.
I do.
Always good to see you, sir. Ivan Bates, the state's attorney for Baltimore City. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. And please, everybody, support, support, support.
Thank you. And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Congresswoman April McLean Delaney will join me, plus Stephanie Moronis of the Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Safety and Engagement and Jeremy Biddle of the Crime and Justice Policy Lab. They'll be here as well. So that's on the way tomorrow.